Hi, I'm Anik Bonet. I produce The Dark North with Paul. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the Montreal Gazette. It's the best way to help us make shows like this. Subscriptions start at just $9.95 a month. Just go to montrealgazette.com/subscribe. Live outside Quebec? Please consider subscribing to the National Post at nationalpost.com/subscribe.
Hi, I'm Paul Cherry, and this is The Dark North, Gangs of Montreal. In today's episode, you'll hear the story of Vito Rizzuto, the mob boss who ran Montreal's underworld for decades. Rizzuto came to Montreal as a child from Sicily, Italy, with his father, Niccolo, and his mother and sister. After a bloody takeover in the late 1970s, his father began running organized crime here. But by the early 1980s, Vito, then in his 30s, was in charge in Montreal. He traveled the world, playing his favorite game, golf. He was seen at casinos and polo matches. He was a night owl and was often seen at Montreal's finest restaurants where he enjoyed whiskey and fine wines. He spoke four languages and was comfortable in boardrooms and bars. He would deny being an organized crime leader. He once told me he was a jack of all trades. Under his leadership, the Montreal Mafia was awash in money. Besides drug smuggling, it ran loan sharking and bookmaking schemes, and even illegal casinos. But by the early 2000s, Vito Rizzuto's reign was coming to an end. We hope you're enjoying The Dark North. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So he had this huge network, and it always involved other criminal organizations. And so his diversification in the underworld was including the Chinese Big Circle Boys, the Calabrian Ndrangheta, the U.S. mobsters, Hell's Angels, Colombian cartels, Florida drug gangs, triads. I mean, basically anyone that could assist him in his enterprise, he was game to form a cooperative alliance with. And this made the Rizzutos really a global criminal enterprise.
You walk anywhere, everybody knew Vito Rizzuto in Montreal and in Canada, who he was. He had power. And in regards to the respect to crime, crime was changing at the time. He had invested in internet gambling, loan sharking. That was always the moneymaker.
It's the middle of the 1990s. Vito Rizzuto is 40 years old, living in a fancy house in Montreal's North End on a street known as Mafia Row. He's married and has three children. His father is often in Venezuela, working with other Sicilian families to traffic drugs. In Montreal, Vito is running the show for the Rizzuto Crime Organization. Officially, on paper, Vito Rizzuto works at his brother-in-law's construction company. In Montreal's underworld, it's a different story. He was heading an organization made up of families mainly from Western Sicily that ran organized crime in Montreal.
Vito Rizzuto was always a little bit of an enigma. He was clearly the man in charge. He was clearly a boss. He was clearly making millions of dollars on these huge international deals. And yet, when you look at his formal business arrangements, he was a virtually impoverished man.
Adrian Humphreys covers crime for the National Post and has written a book about the Rizzuto crime organization called The Sixth Family.
For a while, he was listed as like a vice president, a shareholder of his brother-in-law's construction company, but the company itself was only making like total $40,000 or something like this. And so he had like no credit cards in his own name. He had very little in the way of financial holdings that were formerly his. This was his life. I mean, he owned nothing, and yet he owned everything.
The Rizzuto organization was raking in millions of dollars every year. No deal was too small for him to consider if he could make money off of it.
As a businessman, Vito Rizzuto worked like any ambitious entrepreneur. He sought to diversify and expand his enterprises, always expanding, always diversifying. So he moves from heroin and hashish to cocaine, to counterfeit money, to extortion, to gambling. I mean, really anything that made him money, almost quite literally.
He was accused of attempting to use laundered money in a scheme to build a $7 billion bridge to connect the island of Sicily to the Italian mainland. One of the schemes he was in on seemed particularly far-fetched and involved the former Philippines dictator, Ferdinand Marcos.
police were astounded of what they would stumble across because, you know, he's not just some local boss running local scams and schemes. He was this global super boss that would travel around the world. So one time the cops are on these wiretaps and there's all these calls between Vito Rizzuto and these old friends of his from Montreal that had gone on to the mining business and out in Vancouver and down into the northern United States. And they were discussing this deal, some gold, some ingots. It involved other countries and so forth. And they put it all together. And it turns out that Vito Rizzuto had the authority from one of the deposed Filipino President Ferdinand Marcos's generals to act as Marcos's representative in reattaining control or ownership of the gold bars that Marcos had presumably pilfered during his corrupt time in power.
The RCMP didn't see a crime for them to investigate, so they passed the information on to the Filipino authorities.
To this day, I don't know whether he got his hands on any of Marcos's gold. It seems rather far-fetched, but it does illustrate the extent and the international reach of the unusual activities that Vito would find himself as this international underworld boss.
The money was pouring into the Montreal Mafia, but it brought a challenge, dealing with all that cash. Some mobsters were even bringing money in hockey bags in the back of trucks to deposit at Montreal banks. The Montreal Mafia used a currency exchange office on Peel Street in the heart of downtown Montreal to launder $135 million of drug money. The currency exchange office was convenient, just across the street from a law firm the Rizzutos used. The lawyers would bring cash into the currency exchange in hockey bags, shopping bags, and shoe boxes. The location wasn't just a coincidence. It turned out the currency exchange office was an elaborate RCMP undercover operation aimed at cracking down on money laundering. The employees were RCMP officers. They chatted up the lawyers who were bringing increasingly large amounts of money in to be transferred to foreign bank accounts. Pietro Paletti is a retired Montreal police officer who investigated organized crime.
Everybody thought traditional organized crime was just, you know, a bunch of guys just muscling people. That's what they realized. There was a lot of money here involved. We're talking millions and millions of dollars.
After 4 years, the police cracked down, arresting 57 people, including Rizzuto's lawyer. Rizzuto himself was not arrested. The government prosecutor told reporters, "We know that he is part of the conspiracy, but because of legal principles, we cannot file this evidence against Mr. Rizzuto."
He had been arrested or suspect in many files, and there were a lot of police projects on him. So he was very well known, and he had been exposed by the media, so everybody knew on the island and off the island who Vito Rizzuto was.
Even though police had investigated him for several drug smuggling cases and tax evasion, he was never found guilty.
Vito Rizzuto had always had tremendous success in court. You know, he became sort of the Teflon Don of Canada. He would always seem to defeat charges, be acquitted, avoid being charged altogether. He really danced away from crime after crime after crime.
The only time Rizzuto had been in jail was for setting his brother-in-law's shop on fire in 1972. Once he was established at the top of Montreal's underworld, Rizzuto saw a money-making opportunity in the next-door province of Ontario. As Quebec's violent biker war was ending at the end of the 1990s, the Hells Angels and their rival biker gang, the Bandidos, were taking over motorcycle clubs in Ontario, giving them access to criminal enterprises there.
As much power as Vito had in Montreal, and it was a lot, he wasn't the national crime figure that we came to know him by until he took Ontario, which really means taking Toronto. Toronto had its entirely separate underworld.
Toronto's underworld has traditionally been controlled by gangsters from Calabria, an Italian province at the toe of Italy, just across the Straits of Messina from Sicily.
When the Hells Angels patched over all the Ontario, or many of the Ontario bikers, to become Hells Angels there, all of a sudden, Vito, I think, saw a threat. This very capable drug trafficking organization of bikers was now linked by chapters across Ontario and across Montreal and in fact, across much of Canada. And I think he wanted to replicate that. And he sought to do with the mafia in Canada what the Hells Angels had done and unify the various clans, all of them under the Rizzuto banner.
So Rizzuto made the Toronto mobsters an offer they couldn't refuse. He warned them that the bikers posed a serious threat, but that he could protect them.
He positioned himself, he sold himself as a protector instead of a conqueror.
And the Toronto crime families agreed. Rizzuto now ran the Canadian mafia. But in New York City, where the American mob is based, Rizzuto's organization was still seen as a branch plant or an outpost of the Bonanno crime family. That's one of the famous five crime families in New York. The Bonanno organization came to Montreal to name a captain of the Montreal organization. The natural choice seemed to be Vito Rizzuto.
In New York City, that's like the jackpot. When you're a captain, you make untold wealth. When you're a captain, you have power, you have respect, you have prestige. People treat you different. It's a huge, huge gift in New York. Not so much in Montreal at this time. So they offered it to Vito, and everyone was expecting him to, you know, fall down and say thank you and bless you, give my regards to the boss. But instead, he wasn't interested. And he said that he thought it would be more appropriate if his father, Nick, was offered the captaincy. Now, you know, why he did this, I personally think it had a lot more to do with his respect for his father than for his disrespect for New York. I do believe that the captaincy, any title from New York, was largely meaningless to Vito Rizzuto at this point in his career. However, the idea of accepting it to make peace at the possible expense of disrespecting his father was probably not something he wanted to do. He suggested they offer it to Nick. New Yorkers knew that this was not the right move. They wanted the most powerful player in Montreal to be their captain, and but always a little fearful of Vito and a little fearful of the power of the Montreal guys. They didn't make an issue of it, and they just quietly buried it and never brought it up again.
What Rizzuto was doing was so much more than a traditional mafia captain. He was the godfather. If you are enjoying The Dark North, I think you'll love Gangster House, the new podcast from Imperative Entertainment. Gangster House has everything. Hospital hitmen, FBI informants, a prison escape, a van explosion, and so much more. It's the story of Mike Thievis, the son of Greek immigrants and a man living the American dream with his wife and five kids in 1970s Atlanta. A man consumed by his own greed, excesses, and desire for power. Gangster House comes from the producer of podcast mega hits Atlanta Monster, Broken Hearts, and Monster, the Zodiac Killer. Subscribe to Gangster House right now on your favorite podcast player. At the beginning of the 2000s, the RCMP started another investigation into the Rizzuto crime organization. They called it Project Colisée, the French word for Colosseum, a nod to the Rizzuto's Italian heritage. They put wiretaps on the mobsters' phones and managed to sneak into the cafe where they did most of their business. A small, glass-front shop called the Cosenza Club in a strip mall on Jerry Street in Montreal's Saint-Leonard neighborhood. And that's how they learned about a real estate project that Vito Rizzuto was involved in. He put up none of his own money, but he was pulling the strings on a $71 million development in Montreal's Old Port. The goal, police believe, was to give his son, Nick Jr., a shot at being a legitimate real estate developer.
Why did he get involved? I think Vito had plans for his children. He didn't want them to lead the life he led. And maybe that was an opportunity to go into real estate. Who knows?
Officially, the project was being managed by Tony Maggi, a small-time real estate developer in Montreal's West End. The project was called Le Héritage de Vieux-Port, and it was to transform an abandoned warehouse on Montreal's waterfront into high-end luxury condos. But Maggi was in over his head. He needed money. That's where Vito Rizzuto stepped in.
Now, Vito was very famous within the underworld for not putting a dime of his own money forward on any deal. The partners would be fronting the money, and Vito's people were arranging its passage into Canada or across to the US, or arranging for others to distribute it. His own risk was only imprisonment, which at this point seemed increasingly remote. And if the deal worked, he'd keep, say, 60% of the load or the value of the load. He'll pocket tens of millions of dollars. But if it went sour, some other chump was out the money and likely doing the prison time.
Rizzuto helped arrange financing for Maggi. Here he is, in a recording from a police wiretap. It's a bit hard to hear, but Rizzuto is talking with another developer about getting involved in Maggi's project. Rizzuto says he can control Maggi.
But he thinks it could be good, the thing was. Could we do something there?
Nah, he's not trustworthy.
We'll take it over. Hey, I'll control this fucker. You know what I mean?
Are you sure you can control him?
Of course.
All right, then I'll control Bloom and Dabrowski.
Yeah, I can control him. If we can, listen, he's ready to give us half of the project if we can help him out. You understand?
Rizzuto put his oldest son, Nick Jr., then 35 years old, into the project. Here is another wiretap conversation of Rizzuto talking with Tony Maggi.
Really, Nick? Is he learning something, Nick?
I wake him up every morning, like at 10 o'clock, at 10 o'clock, yeah. He's at the office. I said, this is where you come every day, you know?
So. He's going to learn about construction. He's going to learn how to get his nails in scratch, you know?
Things weren't going well with the project. Pre-sales were slow and the work dragged. But by early 2004, Vito Rizzuto had bigger problems to deal with. An underboss in the Bonanno crime family had become a police informant. His name was Sal Vitale, and he told police Vito Rizzuto had gone to New York in 1981 and was in on the dramatic killing of three mafia capos, or captains. Joe Messina, who wanted to be the head of the Bonanno crime family, ordered the men killed. The murders became famous when they were reenacted in the mob movie Donnie Brasco.
Three captains that were powerful and standing in the way of Joe Messina were lured to a bar by a Montreal gangster named Gerlando Chacha, known as George from Canada. And inside were waiting a bunch of gunmen, two from Montreal. One was Vito Rizzuto. The other was never fully and clearly identified, at least not to the point of laying charges. And the third was Sal Vitale. And when George from Canada gave the signal by running his fingers through his silver hair, that was the signal to come out. And Vito Rizzuto jumped out from the closet. The old-timer from Montreal and Sal Vitale covered the exits, and Vito Rizzuto shouted, "Stick 'em up, it's a holdup." And of course, they weren't being robbed. The only thing being taken was the underworld crown of the for Joe Messina. But the three captains were murdered then and there, and the bodies were disposed of, and it looked to remain a secret for many, many years until Sal Vitale and other mobsters that were finking in New York laid it all out, and police were eventually able to lay charges, including charges against Vito Rizzuto in Montreal for racketeering and aid of murder, or murder and aid of racketeering, I guess.
The Montreal police were keeping tabs on Vito.
We had been in contact with the American authorities 2 months prior. It was a secret operation. Nobody really knew what was going down. We'd leave the office and follow Vito with surveillance crews.
On January 20th, 2004, Paletti and his partner drove up to Rizzuto's house in a police car. They knocked on the door.
And we entered the house, and he thought, the first thing he said, and it's ironic, I hadn't met Vito many, many times before. And he says, "Pietro," he asked his wife to make me a coffee. I said, I don't think it's the time. I got to execute an arrest warrant. And he says, "My lawyer took care of that. It's nothing." I don't think he knew that it was that very that serious. Well, the normal procedure, we arrested him and escorted him to the detention center. He told me in the car. He told him, yeah. He says, "You guys are making a big mistake." He says, "It's going to be a chaos." He was so right. And I think he underestimated it. It's going to even get worse.
On the day of his arrest, Vito learned about what Sal Vitale had told the FBI. And he found out that the American prosecutors were arguing that because of ongoing ties between the Montreal Mafia and Bonanno family, Rizzuto was part of the Bonanno crime family. And his role in that crime family continued after the triple murder, and he was being charged with racketeering, not murder. Rizzuto was transferred to Montreal's Riviere de Prairie prison until he could have a bail hearing, where he could argue that he should be set free to fight the U.S. charges. As he waited for his day in court, Rizzuto continued to run his business behind bars. He kept tabs on the condo project in Montreal's Old Port. Here is Rizzuto in another wiretap conversation. He's in jail, speaking on the phone with Tony Maggi.
"So, I know.
Hey, come on.
I know.
That's going to be one of the hottest places in the city.
It is the hottest place in the city. There is no other place.
It's the hottest, and it's going to be the hottest, more hot. Because that's, that's where the money is going to be spent.
I know.
No, so why not?
You sound tired. You're okay?
No, I'm perfect. I'm tired of because I just finished training.
Oh, yeah.
I do my training.
How are you feeling besides that?
I'm feeling good, Tony. I'm very, very healthy. I slim down.
Yeah, I know. You stand
I read a lot, you know.
Yeah.
I keep busy. Okay.
Rizzuto eventually bought 5 of the condos in the project for a total that cost him just $16,000. He flipped them and made $1.7 million in profit. All this for connecting Maggi to financiers. The Americans wanted Rizzuto in New York to stand trial. He fought extradition to the U.S., even hiring American defense lawyer Alan Dershowitz. Dershowitz was on the defense team for former NFL star O.J. Simpson at his double murder trial and would later represent sexual predator Jeffrey Epstein. A judge ruled that Rizzuto had to stay in jail while he fought extradition. In August 2006, this Canadian Supreme Court ruled that Vito Rizzuto was to be extradited to the U.S. Within hours, he was placed on a plane and flown to New York. In a courtroom in Brooklyn, Rizzuto pleaded guilty to racketeering. In return for the guilty plea, he would get a 10-year prison sentence. In the U.S. justice system, an accused person has to allocute or give details on what crime they committed when they are pleading guilty.
You have to tell the judge what you did. You know, basically, they want to know that they're really convicting the right person, that they have full admission of their role in the crime. And so the judge turned to Vito to say what he did. And Vito seemed quite reluctant to admit to actually being a trigger man. So he sort of says, I was one of the ones that were there at the time. And the judge was outraged at how light and fluffy this allocution was. And it almost got to the point where it seemed like his whole plea agreement might have been derailed by this. Vito seemed unwilling to go far enough to satisfy the judge. The judge was threatening to throw the whole thing out. He had a quick conference with his lawyers, a big huddle, and Vito and his lawyers were, you know, at the courtroom talking quietly. Vito looked quite animated when he was talking with his lawyers. Very, looked like he was, you know, very firm with his hand actions. And we, of course, couldn't hear what he was saying. But eventually, they cobbled together some statement that would admit that he had a gun, at least, and he was involved in the shooting of these guys, in the demise of these guys, but still short of, I think, what the judge was really looking for. But another thing that Vito did right in that case was he waited to the very end. He was actually the last person of a very, very long indictment to face sentencing in this. And I don't think anyone at that point had the stomach to possibly derail or delay the closure of this case, especially just to put away a Canadian who at the end of his sentence was going to be deported back to Canada anyway. And so everyone sort of shrugged and said, okay, I guess that's good enough. And Vito was finally found guilty and sentenced to a substantial prison term in the United States.
Vito Rizzuto was sent to a prison in Colorado. After Rizzuto was extradited, things fell apart for Tony Maggi. There were tensions between him and Vito's son, Nick. In 2008, Maggi was shot several times as he sat in his car at a red light in Montreal's Notre-Dame-de-Grasse neighborhood. He was in a coma and spent 6 months in a hospital. In 2009, Maggi told me he was business partners with Vito Rizzuto's son. He's a smart kid. He's smart in real estate, Maggi told me. The poor guy, he tries to do something in his life, and because of his family's past history, every time he turns around, he gets hit with something. Then, less than 3 weeks later, Nick Rizzuto was killed, shot to death while visiting a condo across the street from Maggi's offices in NDG. Several police sources would go on to say that they believed Maggi ordered the hit on Rizzuto. Their theory was that with Vito Rizzuto far away in a U.S. jail, Maggi felt he could act. Police believe he got a street gang leader named Dukarm Joseph to either shoot Nick Rizzuto Jr. or take part in the slaying. In 2014, Dukarm Joseph was shot and killed. And earlier this year, someone shot and killed Tony Maggi at a condo project he was overseeing in NDG. 3 months after Vito Rizzuto was sent to the U.S., the RCMP took down the leaders of his crime organization, including his 82-year-old father, Niccolo. It was the beginning of the end of the Rizzuto crime organization in Montreal. Next time on Gangs of Montreal.
That arrest, if you're a president of a couple of hundred men, those hundred men all want to be leaders, your boss. They want to take over your job. And they really thought that he wasn't going to make it out of there.
While he was away, people tried to run business as best they could, but no one could fill Vito's shoes.
The Dark North, Gangs of Montreal, is written and produced by Monique Baudin and me, Paul Cherry. Additional production and editing by Carson Jarama. Theme music is by Bryce Hall. Emma Mackay is the Montreal Gazette's digital executive producer, and Lucinda Choden is our editor-in-chief. Special thanks for this episode to David Rudin. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.